From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The execution this past Friday of a prominent Shia cleric and others in Saudi Arabia had UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon making an appeal for calm after Riyadh announced on Saturday that Sheikh Namir Bakir al-Namir was among 47 who had been executed by the Saudi government. The mass beheadings, reportedly the highest single-day tally since 1980, sparked condemnation and protests around the world, which included the ransacking of the Saudi embassy in Iran's capital, Tehran. Last year, Saudi Arabia executed 158 people, its largest tally in two decades. In a phone call with the UN Secretary General, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said the killing of Sheikh Namir was a continuation of a policy that has wreaked havoc in the region and beyond, warning that Riyadh provokes extremism.
We are not natural-born enemies with Iran. It is only the behavior of the Iranian government that continues to interfere in the internal affairs of other countries, particularly our Arab countries, including our own, that is causing us to take this position.
That was the permanent representative of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to the United Nations, Abdullah bin Yahya al-Mualimi, at a press stakeout at the UN headquarters in New York Monday. But the Saudi ambassador's claim of Iranian interference in the internal affairs of its neighbors rang hollow for many, who point out that the Saudis are occupying Bahrain, waging war against Yemen, and backing numerous terrorist groups on the ground in Libya, Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere. Press TV's Reza Golzadeh has more.
In its anti-Iran comments over the past couple of days, Saudi Arabia has accused Tehran of supporting terrorism, but many find the accusations from the Saudi side self-defeating, as Riyadh is widely believed to be sponsoring Takfiri extremists in the Middle East. Few people are now doubtful that the kingdom is responsible for the creation of the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization, which gave birth to hundreds of terror groups, including Daesh. Saudi Arabia openly supports militants trying to topple the Syrian government, and it's accused of orchestrating terror attacks, which claim civilian lives daily across Iraq. It sent its troops to neighboring Bahrain to crush a pro-democracy movement. Saudi Arabia has waged a bloody war on its other neighbor, Yemen, killing some 7,400 people in the past 10 months since its war began. Saudi Arabia's rights record is no better. The Saudi government shows zero tolerance towards dissent, with Sheikh Nimr being one of the latest victims of the crackdown. And it is now struggling to deal with the fallout from its repression of opposition in the kingdom. Despite criticizing Saudi Arabia over the execution of Sheikh Nimr, its Western backers and allies, most notably the US and Britain, have stopped short of taking any genuine measures to force Riyadh into changing its policy towards the region and on dissent inside the kingdom.
Six fighters who attacked an Indian airbase near the India-Pakistan border Saturday night have been neutralized. That, according to India's defense minister, Manohar Parrikar, Tuesday. He added that a four-day-long search and combing operation to secure the compound was still underway. The bodies of 21 refugees, including three children who had tried to cross the Aegean Sea from Turkey to Greece, washed up on the Turkish coastline at two locations. 11 of the bodies were discovered on the shoreline in the district of Eyvalık, while 10 others were found in the Dikili area following rough weather. The Turkish Coast Guard reported rescuing several additional travelers in distress. An explosion was reported Tuesday in the Afghan city of Jalalabad near the consulates of India, Pakistan, and Iran. That, according to a spokesperson for the provincial governor, Atullah Kugyani. Reuters reported early Tuesday that there had been no casualties or damage known thus far. The target of the attack was not immediately known, and as of Tuesday, no one had claimed responsibility. However, the blast followed an attack on the Indian consulate in Mazar-i-Sharif, Afghanistan, on Sunday, with Afghan special forces killing a group of insurgents who were holed up in a house there Monday, ending a 24-hour standoff. Supporters of Venezuela's socialist revolution marched through the streets of Caracas Tuesday in an expression of support for President Nicolas Maduro and grassroots popular power, as the new National Assembly took office for the first time in 17 years under the control of right-wing political parties. Leaders of the incoming right-wing coalition have signaled that they intend to reform or revoke key pieces of legislation passed by the socialists, prompting grassroots organizations to mobilize in defense of gains made over the past decade and a half. The coalition has threatened to revoke price controls that keep basic goods affordable, give foreign companies concessions for infrastructure and other work, and privatize key enterprises and services, including public media.
And for more on that, we spoke with analyst Eric Dreitzer via Skype Wednesday. So I'm going to start with just a little background for our listeners. Venezuela held elections for the National Assembly on December 8th. The assembly was seated yesterday, Tuesday, the fifth day of January. The right wing won a two-thirds majority. However, after a challenge in seven of the districts resulted in an injunction in one of four members, they fell below that threshold. People were in the streets yesterday, both from the right and the left, particularly the left, to support the president against any attacks from the new right-wing legislature and a bunch of legislation that's been passed over the last 15, 16 years from the same. And that's where we are right now.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, what's interesting about what's happening in Venezuela is that there is a political conflict happening between left and right. But because of the actions of the right wing, they've essentially not only tried to challenge the political power of the Socialist Party and of the president, they're actually challenging the very constitution and the impartiality and power of the judiciary in the country as well, because they're essentially arguing that they are not going to honor the decision of the Venezuelan Supreme Court regarding that injunction, regarding the at least temporary removal of three legislators from the National Assembly. So what they're actually doing is, in effect, undermining the Constitution through the back door by challenging the judiciary in this way. That's part of the reason why people were turning out into the streets, because, of course, the right wing has been promising long before this last election, but even leading up to this election, that they will do everything they can to undermine the institutions of the Bolivarian Revolution. One of those institutions was an independent judiciary that would be able to settle any such legal disputes. Now, there's a number of protocols that they've been violating, the right wing, within just the first day in the National Assembly, including trying to muscle out the left wing from speaking, breaking traditionally held protocol in the National Assembly where both sides are allowed to speak. That led to a walkout by socialist legislators. I believe 54 of them walked out of the National Assembly because they were refused the right to speak. So a lot of these seemingly small little conflicts within this larger conflict, I think, illustrate what we're really looking at in Venezuela, which is going to be an ongoing political drama in which the right wing challenges every single independent political, social, and economic institution in Venezuela.
Yeah, they have already promised to, first they keep talking about ending Maduro's presidency. They were doing that well before the election as well, but they started saying that almost immediately from the podium yesterday.
And formally, that's the key, legally right. And formally, because what they will be able to do, assuming they maintain that two-thirds supermajority, is actually have a recall election next year. The Venezuelan constitution requires that the president be allowed to sit for half of his term before any recall referendum can be held. And Maduro was elected to the presidency in 2013, so I believe his term goes until 2019. Therefore, 2016, halfway in that term, is the time that the right wing will be able to have a recall referendum. Now, that's the sort of formal procedure for getting rid of Maduro. Of course, informally, they've been doing everything they can to undermine the government, to undermine the president, in particular, of course, exacerbating the economic war that's been waged against Venezuela through everything from from speculation to capital flight to the shipment of contraband exports out of Colombia and a whole host of other things that have been done. All of this is to undermine Maduro, to undermine the Bolivarian Revolution, and to force people psychologically to associate their personal troubles with the failings of the government, not with any external forces, but solely the failing of the government. Now, this is classic counterinsurgency, U.S. counterinsurgency tactics. You can go back to the declassified CIA memos regarding Nicaragua and the attempt by the United States to wage psychological war against the people of Nicaragua to force them to blame the Sandinista government for all of the problems that have been brought on the country, not external forces. The U.S. has simply applied the Nicaragua model to Venezuela, and it's working perfectly.
Yeah, and kind of mirror image of what's happening in Argentina. You have the judiciary and the presidency on the one side in Venezuela, and the new National Assembly occupied by the right on the other. And you have the opposite in Argentina. You have the new president is from the right, and you have the legislature, the Congress, and the judiciary that are an independent judiciary, and the left is Congress.
Yes, although I have to just make one clarification here that people should know. In Argentina, it wasn't a foregone conclusion that the presidency would be won by the right wing. In fact, Cristina Fernandez's endorsed potential successor could have easily won that election were it not in particular for some on the, let's call it the radical left in Argentina, who didn't want to support what they described as social democratic forces and or Peronist, Kirchnerist, if you will, forces, because they didn't align with their radical left politics or what have you. In Venezuela, that was far more clear cut and polarized left and right. You had more non-participation from some on the radical left in Venezuela, but certainly they were not necessarily out in the streets advocating against the government. And the reason I bring that up is because Macri, the right-wing pro-neoliberal, pro-U.S. president of Argentina now, he won by, I think, less than 2%. Now, that is a very, very clear indication of the importance, particularly in Latin America, of left solidarity against U.S.-backed right-wing neoliberal movements. Now, that same thing is happening in Brazil. The attacks on Dilma Rousseff is right-wing, neoliberal, U.S.-backed opposition. You see that all over Latin America. So it's important to remember how clear the divide is in Latin America, because actually in much of the rest of the world, it's far less clear-cut.
I'm wondering, looking at Venezuela, it appears that Maduro and the Socialist Party have been actively mobilizing their base. And where you had people sitting on their hands there for the election, the numbers were odd. Typically, you had, say, in 2010 for the National Assembly, you had 4 million and change on either side turn out, with a larger vote, of course, by the left then, which allowed them to capture a majority of the National Assembly, even a two-thirds majority because of the weighting of the voting. But it was like 4.9 to 4.1 million. In the last presidential election, you had 6 million, and it was like 56 to 44, I think. So you had 6 million and 8 to 6 million and 1 or something. And this time, you had 6 million vote for the right and only 4 million and change vote for the left. You had essentially the same vote for the left this year that you had in the last assembly election, but the right got their additional normally used only in a presidential year, vote out. In other words, the left sat on their hands. However, as the right-wing government moves against the programs of the left, which have huge constituencies, for example, the millionth house that got delivered last month, you're going to see, and I assume you're going to see real mobilization at the ground start to catch on.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about that. Look, in the day after the election, I was riding the metro cables in Caracas, which connected one of the poor communities up in the hills with the rest of the city. Now, I was speaking to a young woman on the car there who was telling me how before the Chavez government, this metro cable line was not operational. It hadn't been maintained, and people up in the hills had to physically walk down many stairs, more than a mile of just hillside to get to the city, to go to the market and to do whatever they needed to do. Now they're able to ride this. And she was explaining how even the people in her poor neighborhood who benefited so directly from some of the initiatives and programs of the government, even many of them were voting for the opposition, believing, I think quite falsely, that the gains that have been made are permanent, that they simply cannot be taken away. And I think that as the right, and that's just one example of many others that I spoke with who had a very similar idea, similar perspective. Now, once the right wing actually moves in a tangible way to undermine and or rescind and or destroy any of these initiatives and laws and programs, be it the workers' law, which is a worker protection law, be it the some of the Misión Vivienda, the housing mission, or some of the other infrastructure projects, or any of these institutions and initiatives, I think you will see people out in the streets. That's already beginning, and I think that there's going to be quite a lot of buyer's remorse in Venezuela as working class and poor people who cast votes for the opposition out of disgust with corruption and the economic situation, they're going to realize just what they've done, and they're going to realize what the right wing is. Remember, the right wing ran this campaign in a very different way from previous campaigns. They no longer talk about capitalism. They no longer talk about restoring ties with the United States or any of these other things, which are deeply unpopular in Venezuela, which is still very, very much pro-socialist, anti-imperialist, and reveres Chavez to a significant degree. So instead, the right wing in this campaign were talking about socialism. They're saying Capriles even describes himself now as a socialist. They were positioning themselves as hope and change, quote unquote, change from the current government. In other words, an improvement in the economic situation. This is all public relations. This was all marketing, but that was how they did it. And that's how they won the elections. And when they don't deliver the kind of change that people had in their minds, those people will turn on them and they will be out in the streets. And Maduro and the government are trying to capitalize on that as we speak.
You know, you have about 28, 29 million people in Venezuela. And out of that, maybe 12 million are 18 or under. So you have about 18 million people. And out of that, the fullest expression of voting is around between 12 and 14 million. You have this new million units of housing, for example, for people that were living in shanties and worse, now living in modern apartments, free or affordable, truly affordable, figuring even just two adults two per unit to that. That's a constituency of 2 million people, or maybe 15 to 20% of the electorate alone. And that is one of the big targets of this right-wing government. You have across the country cooperatives, all these other things that you've described a number of times here. And again, those are built-in constituencies. So these are real, meat and potatoes issues for people.
Yeah, they are, which is why I think a lot of the people that I spoke with, especially those who cast votes for the Socialist Party, were deeply embarrassed and upset at the fact that many of their compatriots, many of their fellow Chavistas actually voted for the opposition out of anger, out of spite, quote unquote, to teach a lesson to the government. But of course, not realizing or not making the connection that voting for the right wing is is voting against their own interests, because the right wing will do what you're saying. They will try to undermine the Misión Vivienda, the housing mission. They will try to destroy these programs. I mean, we could point to many of them, even beyond just the housing mission. You know, the attempts by the Venezuelan government to build partnerships with the Chinese in terms of automobile production inside of Venezuela. That's a major, major achievement by the government in a country that has never produced its own automobiles, in a country that has been 100% dependent upon imports from the developed world as it relates to, you know, cars and buses and all these types of things. All of a sudden in Caracas on the streets, you see modern brand new buses that are designed in China, manufactured, the parts are manufactured in China and assembled in Venezuela. Now, do you really believe that those types of partnerships continue under a U.S.-backed neoliberal capitalist right wing? I don't think so. People understand that things like subsidies on energy, subsidies on electricity, subsidies on a number of important goods, those could be taken away overnight, just as you saw, Don. I know you've been following it closely. In Argentina, literally overnight, the president devalued the currency and working people were hit very, very hard, literally overnight. That can happen in Venezuela, and in many ways it can happen in a more extreme way there.
And in both places, one of the first moves taken by the right as they took power, either from the presidential office in Buenos Aires or from the National Assembly yesterday in Caracas, they're moving on the public media.
Yeah, exactly, because remember that the media is already almost exclusively controlled by the right wing, but there are government-owned or public-owned media institutions in those countries that have done, I think, yeoman service to the left by countering a lot of the propaganda that comes from the private media. So I think that that's an important point, because if they're able to reassert 100% hegemony over the media, that's going to make it very, very difficult to get the truth out about what's really happening inside the country. I think it was RCTV that had been shut down by the Venezuelan government after they were inciting violence and calling for the death of Hugo Chavez. They had been banned from the airwaves. The opposition, the right wing, has been talking about reinstituting that channel, reopening that media, that media propaganda outfit. That's an example of what they want to do in Venezuela. They want to not only control the economic development, they want to control the information sphere. And unfortunately, I think one of Chavez's mistakes was not moving harder against the private media, because they have a tremendous amount of power over people's thinking in that country.
And then as far as it goes, in terms of Venezuela, there's Telesur, which is a voice all over Latin America, in every place that we've discussed, in Argentina, where, by the way, the new president is moving to pull Argentina's media out of Telesur. But in Brazil, in every place that you have this battle going on, Telesur is there, and it's the only independent voice, and, you know, it's headquartered in Caracas.
Yeah, and well, I think Telesur Spanish, I believe, is headquartered in Caracas. I think the English is in Ecuador, but regardless, yes, Telesur is very important, is a very important resource, and without something like that, a lot of the information about what's really going on, some of the inner political workings, particularly for those of us who follow English language media, would simply not be there. So it's a very important resource, and one that obviously needs to be defended. But I would stress also that every institution of the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, from the media to the workers' laws to the commune movement. All of these things have to be defended, not simply by the government, but by the people. That's part of what we're seeing. Just in the days after the election, when I was there, you saw a mass outpouring of people in the streets ready to defend with their bodies El Cuartel, which is the resting place of Hugo Chavez, which some right-wing legislators had talked about privatizing and dismantling. They were prepared to march in the streets with Maduro in defense of the workers' law, in defense of a number of other very important pieces of legislation, the anti-GMO law, which is the seed bill, which was recently passed. All of these things, I think we could say, have been mobilized by people power, not by the government, but by people power. This is why Diosdado Cabello, one of the highest ranking government officials, was meeting with representatives of all of the communes around the country, meeting with representatives of various social movements, meeting with all of these different people at the grassroots level in order to be able to do what the government unfortunately has not done enough of in recent years, namely working in concert with the people in order to advance the ideals and objectives of the revolution. That's, I think, one of the positive features of this election. It has forced the government to be more responsive to the people. And in order to counter the right wing, they've been doing precisely that.
And as you see a mobilization of the left on the streets, and you can bet that there will be whatever mobilization they can put together on the right to counter it. The role of the military going forward becomes very important. Historically, that hasn't always worked out very well for the left. But what do you think is going to happen in Venezuela if it comes to that?
Well, this is a question a lot of people have asked. I can only relate what I've been told from people who I think are far better placed than I am to answer that question. People who are former members of the government, former members of Chavez's cabinet. They've told me on separate occasions that the army is still squarely in the Chavista camp. That part of that has to do with their personal loyalty to Chavez. Chavez, of course, coming from the army. Chavez, of course, having always had the loyalty of the army as his, you know, the muscle behind the people power that supported him. Chavez really worked hard to build up the army as an independent institution, one that could not simply be changed when the political winds shifted direction. And that's part of the reason why the army receives political and ideological training. That's part of the reason why they receive training in Cuba, to keep them not only militarily and physically independent, but ideologically, politically independent from whatever movements are happening on the political scene in Venezuela. And it seems that the army is still very much in that camp. Now, it should be said that an objective analysis has to include the possibility that high-ranking army officials may or may not have been approached by the United States and its various proxies in attempts to buy them off. I say that because that's what the United States has done in every single country that it has targeted. It always focuses on high-ranking military officials, tries to buy them off, offers them, you know, who knows, mansions with swimming pools in Miami and, you know, God knows what else they might offer them. So there is the potential for the U.S. and the right wing to try to pick off some of the high-ranking officials in the military. But from all indications, that does not seem to be something that the left is really afraid of. In other words, you have the potential for a confrontation wherein the people and the political left are backed by the military, while the right and its supporters are backed by the police, who are far more in the pockets of the wealthy capitalist class in Venezuela. So that sort of a confrontation could get very ugly, and it could turn very violent violent. And that scenario is, of course, tremendously dangerous because I think we all know where that's going. That will then have CNN broadcasting images from Venezuela saying that Maduro, the dictator, is killing his own people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know where that's going. So that scenario is, of course, very dangerous for Venezuela because it opens it up to potential international intervention. That's certainly a very real possibility. It's also possible, people should guard against this, that the right wing is doing whatever it can to provoke precisely that kind of a confrontation so that they can then call their patrons in Washington and move harder against the government. Also entirely possible, the right wing is certainly not above provoking anything up to and including civil war.
Eric Traitzer, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.